The Tom Woods Show, episode 2074.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, Tom Woods here. Don't forget you can get one of my books in audiobook format for free. So that includes my book, Real Descent, which is narrated by me. My New York Times bestseller, Meltdown on the Financial Crisis of 2008, featuring a foreword by Ron Paul, Nullification, and others. Just head over to tomwoodsaudio.com, sign up for Audible, and if you decide you don't want Audible, you get to keep the free audiobook they give you anyway. tomwoodsaudio.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. We're talking about Russia and Ukraine today, trying to make sense of what's going on. And of course, when a good, consistent libertarian talks about foreign policy, he's going to be accused of sympathizing with so-and-so, or you just support such-and-such, or whatever. I don't sympathize with so-and-so, and I don't support such-and-such. I'm just trying to understand the world at a level of sophistication slightly beyond where I find Mitch McConnell and Nancy Pelosi, between whom I can detect zero difference in matters like this. So I've asked Gilbert Doctorow to talk to us today. He's a political analyst based in Brussels. He holds a PhD in Russian history from Columbia University. His recent books include Memoirs of a Russianist from the Ground Up and Volume 2, Russia in the Roaring 1990s. Gilbert, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm thinking back to the old days when we used to get our news partly from the TV, but also from weekly news magazines. And of course, in a week, so much can change. I have a daily podcast, but even with a daily podcast, I feel like from one day to the next, this type of situation can change. But I still have to take a snapshot of this moment in history and say something about it, because I think it'll still be useful, no matter what happens, to get some kind of historical perspective on what's going on here. Let me start with this before we get into any of the details. One thing that disturbs me about all this, observing social media, and of course, the mainstream news. What disturbs me is the way the elites can decide that they are going to set the agenda for what's supposed to matter to me and what my priorities need to be. So the conflict in Yemen has been absolutely horrific. And yet no memo went out saying, all right, everybody, you're going to have Yemen's flag in your social media avatar, and you're going to be obsessed with this and talk about nothing else. We never got that. I mean, yes, some people know about Yemen, not very many, a handful know about it. But on this, it's everybody must morally drop everything that might be of competing concern and obsess over this. And we've got the Simpsons TV show issued a little drawing showing all the Simpsons characters holding Ukraine flags. Now, I don't remember them holding Yemeni flags or any of these other conflicts. And as soon as you say this, you get accused of, quote, whataboutism by low IQ people. I'm not even going to address that. My concern is I just don't like this idea that we have what we laughingly call our intellectual class who will decide for me what my concerns need to be, to the point where everyone feels the need to scramble to demonstrate loyalty to this. Now, it could well be that they're right. I'm not excluding the possibility that they're right. That doesn't make this any less creepy to me.
Well, yes. The public interest in the Ukraine situation has a number of reasons. An obvious one is that there are a lot of Ukrainians living in North America. There are not too many Yemenis living in North America. So the home team, the cheerleaders, are there in the American Middle West, and not only, and certainly in Canada, where the Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, is of Ukrainian derivation and is viscerally anti-Russian. So the issue has a domestic dimension coming from the large number of migrants from Ukraine going back to the 19th century who are in North America. However, the last few days, there are still more compelling reasons why people would pay attention. One being that we haven't heard about the mortal threat of nuclear war for 30 years, and now it suddenly appeared on the front pages of the newspaper. So this would get people's attention. And I can tell you that it is precisely the plan of Vladimir Putin to get your attention and to overcome the stubborn resistance of those same elites that you mentioned to deal with Russia as an equal and as a party that has claims to a decision-making role at the board of directors table governing the world. This is a new Russia, an assertive Russia, which has come about for a couple of reasons, one being America's present particular weakness, and the other being Russia's present particular strength. And these two issues are correlated. There is no question of many. There are many people going back several months, American foreign policy community, who have believed that Russia would be, as they see it in their very schematic, almost childish scenarios for how decisions are made by world leaders, that Russia would be tempted to try something given the disastrous withdrawal of United States forces from Afghanistan. Now, I don't dismiss that as being irrelevant. It certainly is relevant, and the whole world paid attention to the incompetence and cowardice that U.S. forces displayed in August of last year when they pulled out of Afghanistan. There's also the factor of the age and the mental acuity of our president. You will remember that in his first weeks in office, Joe Biden was asked by a reporter whether Vladimir Putin is a killer, and he instinctively and answered in the affirmative, a very unpresidential thing to do. But the response from the Russians was to make light of Joe Biden as being mentally incompetent, age-related. So there is a certain contempt in decision-making levels in Russia for the president himself, not to mention contempt for his advisors like Blinken. Behind that, as I've just spoken about the weakness side of the U.S., the other side of the equation is the remarkable strength and self-confidence of Russia since 2018, when in March of 2018, as part of his electoral program, Vladimir Putin, during his State of the Union address on the 1st of March, rolled out the whole family of new cutting-edge strategic and tactical weapons, and in particular, the most remarkable ones are the hypersonic weapons, nuclear capable for short and medium and long range attacks. And he said at the time that you will pay notice. Well, there was a lot of scorn in American media. The Russians could even think of coming up with something that the United States didn't have. And so his call for attention did not garner the interest of the public, though I don't doubt that Pentagon people paid attention. But the public was unaware of what the Russians had achieved and what this meant for their self-confidence. Meanwhile, the Russian economy had become quite resilient and stress-resistant, so that Russia felt prepared by this spring, by this past fall, to risk a showdown with the United States. And so this combination of factors has brought us to where we are right now.
I appreciate that background as to why now, because it's true that I can think of reasons that Russia would feel a particular way, but why now to take the action? And it seems as if this confluence of factors is the answer to that. Now, the thing is, it's very hard to have the kind of discussion that America needs to have right now because of the way the issue has been framed. That if there's any nuance introduced here at all, you know the ridiculous low IQ names you get called. And that's by design. They intend it to be that you're not able to have the kinds of conversations you need. You need to pretend that history began 10 minutes ago. And I just don't do that. Now, at the same time, I hate to have to state the obvious, but you know, being of my philosophical bent, there's no way I can even, by implication, appear to be endorsing what Russia's doing in Ukraine. I can't. I mean, there's even when you're dealing with the completely corrupt elites of the West, you got to come up with some other way to handle them. And especially when they're not the brightest bulbs of all time. But I still want to talk a little bit about very recent history. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you might be able to say something about what happened in Ukraine in 2014 mm-hmm. that may have led us down this path?
Well, you hear very little about the word coup d'etat in American media, whereas you hear a lot about it in Russian media. What we're talking about is the events in February 2014, when, against a background of popular opposition to the Yanukovych government, which was said to be pro-Russian, but that has to be treated with a great deal of caution, the legitimate government of Ukraine, with its elected president, Yanukovych, was trying to go down the middle and to steer a course for Ukraine between Russian and EU suitors. Unfortunately, he lost balance. Unfortunately, he did not, that is the Ukrainian president, did not use force at the moment when it was needed to take back the streets. That is a separate issue. The more relevant issue is what was going on in Ukraine against the background of a popular revolt against the government that large swathes of society did not like. And what was going on was the preparation of a coup d'etat. That is to say, small groups of militants, radical nationalists, neo-fascists in the literal sense, not in some fancy description by people who throw names around. No. Genuine subscribers to white power and to an anti-Russian tool to give a Ukrainian identity to a mixed population, to a country which was, in terms of culture, language, identity, 40% Russian-speaking and 60% Ukrainian-speaking. The west of the country, you have to remember that Ukraine was not exactly an artificial construct, which is what Vladimir Putin was saying in the last few weeks as he began to unveil his plans for Ukraine, but it was a country that consisted of several different populations with different traditions, which were not compatible. And I've just given you the big picture of 60-40 as the kind of division in language speakers. Now let's put it in geographic terms. The west of the country, the far west, around the area that American newspaper readers and CNN followers will know, the area around Lviv, or Lvov as it's called in Russian, that was formerly within the Austrian Empire. Lviv was since it was known as Lemberg. And it was a very big center of Ukrainian nationalism, a cradle of nationalism. In the 19th century, it was also a big Jewish center. It was a center of mysticism, both Christian mysticism and Judaic mysticism. So it was a country with a lot of different ideologies and a big thinking center. It was also part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, was engaged in an imperial struggle with Russia. Now, most people who study history and think of empires think of them as overseas empires. The unique feature of these two empires is they were land empires on the Eurasian continent. And they were competing in the Balkans, which is what triggered World War I, the conflict between Serbia and the Croatian areas ruled by Austria-Hungary. And they were competing in the area that we now know as Ukraine. The west part and Galicia were within the territories of Austria-Hungary, and the eastern part, which is most of what you see on the map when you look at Ukraine today, were part of the Russian Empire. The Austrian-Hungarian Empire fostered Ukrainian national identity, including the use of the language as a tool, as a weapon. We would call this today's language weaponized Ukrainian identity against the Russian Empire. And we are now, 150 years later, reaping still the fruits of that illicit marriage. That is to say, the most fervent and radical nationalists in Ukraine come from the western part of the country. The eastern part of the country was more heavily Russian, in Russian culture and language, than the national average. And three areas stand out. Two of them are what we call the oblasts or regions. Now they call them republics of the Donbas, and the third was Crimea. The most heavily Russian was Crimea. Maybe 90% of the population was not only Russian-speaking, but ethnically Russian. I want to draw a line under that term, because Russian was the national language of the Russian Empire. Not the only one. German was another national language of the Russian Empire, strange as it may sound to your listeners, because the Baltic states were German-speaking and ruled by an emperor who was in Moscow. Well, anyway, I don't want to make things too complicated and read a lecture history here. The point is that the eastern part of Ukraine was most heavily Russian in Crimea, which was until 1954, when Khrushchev donated or gifted Crimea to the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. Remember, this was all the Soviet Union, and geography didn't make a great deal of difference because nobody believed that the Soviet Union would ever collapse. So it was made administratively part of what was Ukraine. However, the basic population was always Russian. The city of Sevastopol was 100% Russian. It was the most important naval installation in the Black Sea, had been for the preceding 150 years, and was a part of Russian national tradition. It was inconceivable, though I'm speaking now in romantic national terms. Let's come back to what would drive the thinking of the Kremlin, which is not romantic nationalism, but realpolitik. And from a realpolitik standpoint, from a power standpoint, a strong power, hard power standpoint, it was essential that Russia keep control of the naval base where it had 17,000 of its soldiers garrisoned under the terms of a long-term lease signed with the Ukrainian state after it became a separate country in 1991 or 1992. So the fate of Crimea was sealed by realpolitik reasons. There was no way that the Russian ruling elites would allow Crimea to go to remain part of a Ukraine that was, thanks to a coup d'etat, which I alluded to earlier, stage managed by the United States in February 2014. They would never allow Crimea to go to stay with the Kiev regime and thereby lose their naval presence in the Black Sea. That's a foregone conclusion. It was ratified by a referendum, a fair and square, where Russian annexation or reunification received massive support. The other two areas, which were predominantly or more heavily Russian-speaking than the rest of Ukraine, were this Donbas. Why so? Because, again, it was artificially added to the core of the Ukraine going back to the start of the Soviet period in 1922. So the basic population, again, was largely not only Russian-speaking, but ethnically Russian, with an identity as Russians. However, the Kremlin had reason to believe that these people in the Donbas were not as potentially loyal to Moscow as was the case of Crimea, and they did not want to unnecessarily violate international law by extending to the Donbas in 2014 the kind of protection and ultimately reunification with Russia that was militarily within their grasp. And so they left these afloat. There were two attempts by Kiev to recapture and to bring under its direct rule these rebelling provinces of Donbas. They were important economically. The Donbas had received enormous investments in the Soviet Union time in industry. It was a significant part of the gross national product of Ukraine. So it was a matter of contention between the local population and the overlords in Kiev what the fate would be. There were two attempts by Kiev to take back Donbas by force, by military force. They were defeated miserably by a combination of, shall we call them, Russian volunteers, but basically the local forces, which surrounded, created what they call a cauldron around the basic military units of Ukraine and forced them to raise the white flag or be slaughtered. The consequence of that was the Minsk agreements. There were two phases of it, but the point is the Minsk agreements were a compromise between the two republics, self-declared republics, and the government in Kiev, which was heavily influenced by the people who engineered, with American support, the coup d'etat of February 2014 and forced the legitimate government to flee, installing a prime minister, Yatsenyuk, who was virtually chosen by the American State Department, to be precise, by Victoria Nuland, in acting in cahoots with the Mr. Pyat, the American ambassador in Kiev at the time. So you have this background of a twice attempted military reinstatement of the rebelling provinces under the sway of Kiev. And you had the Minsk agreements, which ended in what was supposed to be a peace process that would lead to a federalization of Ukraine, whereby those two provinces would be given extensive autonomy. Now, everything has a political dimension, and I've described to you the weighting of Russian speakers versus Ukrainian speakers in the country as a whole. I've described the still heavier weighting of Russian speakers in the eastern provinces. And now let's talk about the electoral results of that in the history of Ukraine since it became an independent state in 1992. The results were great instability at the national level in Ukraine and alternating presidencies of people who were said to be either pro-Russian or pro-Ukrainian identity. Now, these labels were exaggerated. There never was, I think, a truly pro-Russian president of Ukraine, but there were presidents who tried to balance the interests of Russian speakers and fervent nationalists and hold on to power. So in the elections for the parliament, in the elections for the president, the electoral weight of those two republics, now republics, formerly regions, and particularly of Crimea, gave great support. Now, we're speaking about 6-7 million people in a nation that was five times that size. So it is a significant part of the overall population of Ukraine, and that part was very heavily pro-Russian. And it influenced the outcome of parliamentary elections and federal elections. The net result of the loss of Ukraine was already a dilution of the overall Russian-speaking power, political power within Ukraine. The rebellion of those two provinces or regions, which became self-declared republics, that took 4 million people or 5 million people out of the electoral mix in Ukraine and meant that the country as a whole was more skewed towards Ukrainian nationalists than towards the Russian-speaking minority. That's where we were when the national government in Ukraine began to move back from and never to implement the terms of the Minsk Agreement, which had been a compromise between the winning and losing sides in the armed conflict of 2014-2015. Why do I say compromise? Because the republics did not want it. They did not want to submit any which way to rule by the people who were established as the governing class in Kiev. So they agreed under pressure from Moscow to enter into negotiations with Kiev on a federalized Ukraine where they would enjoy extensive autonomy. From the standpoint of Kiev, this was not a very happy compromise because they feared that if they brought back those two republics and reinstated them as provinces in a federalized Ukraine, the voters in those reinstated regions would veto the entry of Ukraine into NATO, which was a great ambition of the radical nationalists who were running the show in Kiev as from February 2014. Well, this is a context. In those 8 years which have passed since then, Ukraine did absolutely nothing to implement the Minsk agreements. And in the 2 months before Mr. Putin decided to strike, President Zelensky and his people in his government said openly that they had no intention of implementing Minsk because it threatened the survival of the Ukrainian state. So this was part of the context which explains Mr. Putin's decision to recognize those two long-suffering regions. And why do I say that? Because in the whole 8 years that have passed since 2014, 2015, there has been, let's call it a glowing war. Not a really full-scale war, but a system of daily barrages of artillery and small arms fire, primarily coming from the Ukrainian army and nationalist radicals on the west side of the demarcation line with these two republics. And they were killing people every day, and destroying the lives of the residents of these two self-proclaimed republics. It had reached a point, it was a nightmare existence for many of these people. And while we know that areas that have seceded from the post-Soviet republics in which they were a constituent part, such as happened in Georgia, Abkhazia, and South Ossetia, which seceded because they are their own national ethnic identities who did not want to be assimilated or crushed by the predominant Georgian population and government based in Tbilisi, or, as in another case, the Transnistrian population, a region within Moldova, a Russian ethnic enclave in Moldova. There, the seceding populations have endured, since their secession, what are called frozen conflicts. There isn't any hot fighting going on. It's the overall jurisdiction and the legal standing of these secessionist areas was left suspended. But in the case of the Donbas, there was a semi-hot war going on with casualties every day. And that made it impossible for the inhabitants to live a normal existence. The final factor that I want to bring into play when we consider the very recent developments that sparked what we see on our television screens now, the fighting in Ukraine, was the unbelievably unprofessional and stupid remark by the president of Ukraine, Zelensky, during his visit to Munich less than 2 weeks ago, during which he said to a rapturous audience, because he was the hero of the day, Ukraine was the poster child of the Munich Security Conference 2022, he said that Ukraine intended to withdraw from what was called the Budapest Memorandum of 1994, which denuclearized Ukraine and which gave it security guarantees, and would proceed to develop its own nuclear weapons. That was the step too far, which made it inescapable for Vladimir Putin to act now and to ensure a change of government, a change of regime in Ukraine that would overturn the illegal change of regime that the United States supervised, engineered, and supported in 2014.
Hey everybody, let's take just a minute to remind you that there are so many things that people can struggle with, like anxiety and depression and stress and relationship issues, and they afflict us for so long and so regularly that we come to assume that this is just part of life, that there's nothing we can do about this. This is just our fate. In fact, we're so caught in it that the very question of whether it could be avoided, whether there's anything that could be done about it, sometimes doesn't even cross our minds. Well, Woods is here to tell you that there is help in the form of our sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp will figure out exactly what it is you need, match you up with a licensed professional therapist who specializes in what you need. It's convenient, professional, and affordable. You can check out the ton of testimonials on their website. And by the way, just in case they don't fix you up with your perfect therapeutic match, they'll get you another one. So many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/woods. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/woods. There's a lot to unpack there, but the particular thing I want to elaborate on is, of course, the issue of NATO. If you look at the expansion of NATO after the Cold War, after which you might make a case for disbanding NATO rather than expanding it, I was just reading David Stockman, you know, who was the budget director under Reagan, who has been writing up a storm on this, and he said something like, "What juvenile minds determined the need for a U.S. alliance with Slovakia, Slovenia, Romania, Montenegro, Macedonia?" Or then saying, look, in what way is the United States helped by having the assistance of the 6,000 military in Latvia, the 6,400 in Estonia? In a way, it recalls what J.D. Vance got in trouble for saying. He's running for U.S. Senate. He was at CPAC over the weekend, and he said something, I don't know the entire passage, but something along the lines of, I really, frankly, don't care what is going on in that part of the world. And of course, everybody, don't you know, the elites have told you that you have to prioritize this and nothing else matters. But his point was, and maybe he's just a politician, I don't know, but at least in principle, he's saying that his campaign is about trying to help middle America through a difficult time. And I don't see how elite preoccupations halfway around the world have anything to do with that. And most people have enough trouble trying to provide for the people in their immediate circles. And that is the normal way that almost every moral theologian of the West has thought about this question, that you have responsibility to your immediate family. And then after that, you have friends, you have your neighborhood, you have your workplace, you have local civic groups you might belong to. And life proceeds in this series of concentric circles. And we have only so much time, so much energy, so much ability, so large of a heart, so much emotional capability that we're only able to extend it so far. And so he was simply repeating a moral commonplace and was absolutely savaged for it. And I don't think there was anything wrong at all with what he said. Now, at the same time, on this NATO matter, if you bring this up, people will say, oh, that's just you're just making an excuse, and the Russians were going to do what they were going to do regardless, and quit making excuses for them. Even if you had had an ironclad guarantee that Ukraine would never be admitted to NATO, this still would have happened. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, I mean, there are a number of issues here, and I will deal with a few of the lesser ones first, and then I'll come to the big issue, where I hope I will not scandalize listeners, because I want to put this in a bigger frame than just Ukraine and NATO, or of the illusory contributions made to NATO and the United States by each successive wave of expansion, where indeed the last waves of expansion did not increase the strength of NATO, but diminished it significantly with every passing accession. But we'll get to that afterwards. Let's look at the immediate question of NATO accession for Ukraine. It is a phony issue. To understand Vladimir Putin, you have to understand why it's a phony issue. The United States has arrangements with a number of states that are comparable to what it has been doing in Ukraine. And you go back several months to remarks made by Vladimir Putin of how, despite Ukraine not being a NATO member, NATO and the United States were enjoying all the benefits that accrue from having a country like that as a member of NATO without actually conferring membership. Now, what do I mean? In recent weeks and in the past few days, there's been a lot of discussion of Finland and Sweden, which are presently outside and have been from the beginning, have been outside of NATO, signing up and joining NATO. In point of fact, if they were to join NATO, it would only benefit them and not give NATO itself any benefits that it doesn't already enjoy in their countries. Both countries have what are called memoranda of understanding with NATO. by which they are obliged to grant NATO access to their territory and facilities and personnel at any time that NATO declares that it needs such assistance for an ongoing mission. Their joining NATO would only result in their coming under the Article 5 and receive reciprocal benefits, if you want to call it, of the U.S. military umbrella. In the case of Ukraine, in practice, the United States has been doing exactly what it has with the Nordic countries under their memoranda of understanding. It has been bringing infrastructure and personnel to Ukraine in violation of the Ukrainian constitution, which does not allow foreign military bases on its soil. These have been called training missions. That's a euphemism for what are de facto bases. It has prepared the way by renovating and equipping Ochakov, which is a naval base on the Black Sea, that is less than 100 kilometers from Sevastopol, from the Crimea, to turn it into what the United States hoped to enjoy had the Crimea not withdrawn from Ukraine and been reunified with the Russian Federation, namely a major center of reconnaissance and a reserve for destruction of the Russian Black Sea Fleet. The Russians have not turned a blind eye to that. And they already announced 2 months before the onset of Vladimir Putin's incursion, invasion, call it what you will, into Ukraine. But this was unacceptable. So their conflict with Ukraine was set in the context of their broader displeasure with the whole structure of security in Europe that is based on the existence of NATO. NATO is the European security architecture. And the whole purpose of NATO is to keep Russia out and down. Under those circumstances, the long-term life of NATO is unacceptable and is threatening the vital interests of Russia. And it was only a question of time when they would strike. And they struck now. Now, to understand what NATO means, you have to look at this whole issue from a slightly different perspective. We all were electrified. We all became woke, were made aware of the very great issue in the States of the racial injustice that is systematic. And part of the imagery that came out of this, from the murder that touched off the Black Lives Matter movement, was the knee to the neck. NATO is America's knee to the neck of Europe, and through Europe, of the world. So those who want to dismiss NATO lightly are missing the point. It is the means of American control of Europe. And if we had any doubts about that, just see what has happened in the last week and how all of Europe has snapped to attention and has submitted to the American sanctions from hell. So there is the answer to your question. And Mr. Putin is now, with Russia, taking on the whole Western world. It's quite incredible. You can say either he's mad. That's what the average person would say, who can't imagine breaking with conformity and taking the risks, the existential risks that Putin's Russia is now taking. Although it has some moral comfort from China, I wouldn't, if I were a Russian, I wouldn't look to a Chinese life raft to save me from my Titanic going down. What he's doing now is historic. And either he will crash and burn and Russia will cease to exist, or he will win and NATO will cease to exist. So no one can say how this will end, but that is a historic moment. That will be probably the most important moment in all of our lives. Yes, that's where we are today.
Of course, the tricky part of recording this right now is that, as you say, nobody knows how it's going to come out. Nobody knows what the next thing is. I mean, we're hearing that there are talks commencing in Belarus, but that's all I know. So I don't really know how to put a period or an exclamation mark. We have to put a question mark, I guess, at the end of this episode. But Supposing you had, because you do have, only 30 to 60 seconds with the average American, and you wanted to say something that you thought would be helpful for that person to grasp what's going on, what would you say?
Your life is in danger. And if you have any doubts about it, they will be resolved in the next few weeks. Because if this escalation continues, you can be certain that Russian submarines carrying these phenomenal new weapons will be surfacing just outside U.S. territorial waters. We are at a historic moment, and I hope there will be historians to record it afterwards. But Mr. Putin has been on record that he does not contemplate a world without Russia. And if the American intent is to destroy Russia, then the American intent will be self-destruction. It will be literally the end of the world. Now, I hope there are enough people who have pens and can write to their congressmen and can pass that message along, because it hasn't sunk in yet. The country is facing an existential threat of its own making, and the escape from this threat is in front of everybody's nose. It's to do a deal with Mr. Putin, which will not be humiliating, which will not sacrifice American prosperity, but which will sacrifice its hegemonic control of the whole world, which has a very poor record in the last 30 years. So my recommendation is to take a pen and write to your congressman and say, oh, woman, and to your senator and say, fellows, our nation's existence is in the balance. Smarten up and prepare to compromise.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens. I think right now what's going on, and as we've seen from the way various dissident voices have been treated in the West in recent months and years, that I think there's an attempt or a desire to shut down and silence pretty substantial slices of opinion in the U.S. and to punish them, to prevent them from getting access to money and the normal functioning of society. And I can easily see that being extended to what is considered to be alleged, quote, Russian propaganda. If you're uttering Russian propaganda, which simply means you'd like to see something other than the end of the world occur here, which is really what we're saying, then you're one of the deplorables who deserves to be unpersoned. You know, they talk a lot about marginalized groups. Well, there is a marginalized group. You and I constitute a marginalized group, a group that says, wait a minute, I'm not going along with this. I don't like what's happening right now. Yes, I agree with you on that. But I'm not going along with the implicit train of other propositions that I am expected implicitly to accept. I will not do it. And we belong to a small group of people for whom the regime has, to say the least, zero sympathy, and who would very much love to see us on the margins of society for having dissident views. So I appreciate your willingness to come out and express those dissident views. If people want to follow you, how can they do so?
Well, as I said, everybody's got a pen and paper or email, and they can appeal to their congressman. The situation is not as dire as you're making it. And the people who are sane are not such a tiny minority. Before Mr. Trump, all of us would have faced what you were suggesting, that we would be mercilessly persecuted. The single benefit that I can think of Trump's presidency was the end of McCarthyism and a thousand flowers blooming in terms of academics, think tank people coming out with their views, which they had not dared to utter before Mr. Trump's presidency. As it is today, you have the National Interest magazine was publishing views on why the United States should capitulate. Unthinkable 5 years ago, but there it was. I don't think that I have to make a point. The Russians will make the point for themselves and for us. What I am saying, I'm not walking around with a sandwich board that the end of the world is nigh. I think people will see it themselves when the Russian submarines make, as they will inevitably make in the next 2, 3, 4 weeks, surfacings off the Jersey coast. Submarines the United States was totally unable to track because they are super silent, and make aware the American media that it can be obliterated in 4 minutes. So I'm not doing Mr. Putin's work for him. I'm not a spokesman for him. I'm a spokesman for sanity and self-preservation of the American nation. And I don't have to overmake my case. It will be completely apparent in the next few weeks if we continue on the hunkering down and denying what's in front of our noses. And there are a few people, even in high positions, who understand that. And I start with the CIA director, Burns. People like you and me don't have to read him a lecture. He knows perfectly well what's going on. The question is, when will he be properly listened to by our president? And when will this blithering fool, Blinken, be sidelined?
Well, the key, as I leave you, I mean, I wonder if because of the bungled withdrawal from Afghanistan, I wonder if Biden thinks of himself as being perceived as weak. And therefore now, if he might have been inclined to be diplomatic, it's harder for him to do so because he can't be perceived as weak two times. I wonder if that's a factor.
Of course it's a factor. But as I said, if faced with instant death, which it's within Mr. Putin's power to display to the states and to Mr. Biden, he may have to rethink this question of, is it really bad to be perceived as weak?
Yeah.
So we'll see how it plays out. As I say, nothing is off the table, sad to say, including the end of the world. I just know that the Russians are no more interested in dying than you or I am. And I assume that they will find a sufficiently clever way of bringing their case to the American public where it doesn't need our words today. But maybe when that moment comes, people will think back of what we have said and understand that they should have been listening more closely.
Well, Gilbert Doctorow, I appreciate your time today. You have a website people can follow?
Yes, at www.gilbertdoctorow.com. And people can also find me on LinkedIn.
Okay, I will put links up at tomwoods.com/2074.
And if you go to Amazon.com, you can find my 5 books, including essays going back to 2014, 2015, when the events that we see today took shape. That is the coup d'etat in Ukraine and its aftermath.
Okay, I will also put a link to that as well. And again, my thanks. I appreciate you doing this in a highly fluid situation, but at some point I have to say something about it. And I heard you on another program, and so I'm glad that we had a chance to talk today. Thanks again.
Well, thanks. Thanks again for this time. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, some sad news to report before we wrap up. Tom Woods Show guest Paul Cantor, English professor at the University of Virginia, has died. He was a tremendous scholar of Shakespeare and popular culture and a lot more, and widely respected. And back in the day, he had been a member of Ludwig von Mises' seminar at New York University. So very, very sad to lose Paul Cantor. Then secondly, also just days ago, Gary North passed away. He did so much of the legwork in putting together the Ron Paul homeschool curriculum, which, as you know, is excellent and outstanding, ronpaulhomeschool.com. But probably the most prolific person I ever knew. He was extraordinarily knowledgeable in American and European history, in economics, also business and marketing. Man, could he write advertising copy and a great headline. Back when he was writing the articles for Tea Party Economist, he was writing 7 articles per day. You probably thought I was going to say 7 articles per week. He would write 7 articles a day. And then later, he scaled that back, just writing for his own website, to 4 articles per day. 4 articles per day while also writing books of various kinds. He has an enormous, I think he's got approximately 50 or so titles, including his very first book, Marx's Religion of Revolution, is a very interesting analysis of Marxism. He had his critics, but you put all his critics together and they don't amount to 1 week of his output. He worked at the Foundation for Economic Education for some time and then was largely an independent scholar. So 2 major voices in the world of the Austrian school have been silenced, which is all the more reason for us to redouble our own efforts. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.